Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black power, black power, black power, brothers and sisters. Thank you for tuning in to the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense Nightly Broadcast. Tonight, brothers and sisters, we have a very special program that we're going to be putting into our rotation. That's a YouTube channel that's going to be giving us a lot of information as to the current events that are taking place in Africa, as well as throughout the Pan-African diaspora. So this network is called Make Africa Great, and it features Ambassador Eric Conner. We have Professor Lumumba, Julius Malema, and several other freedom fighters on the continent that are part of the host of this very dynamic programming that we're going to be kicking off tonight, but will remain a stifle in our rotation on the New Black Panther Party Radio. So without any further ado, I'm going to play tonight's episode. We're going to hear from Ambassador Eric Conner, Professor Lumumba, and Julius Malema, as they are going to be giving us up-to-date information as it relates to the Pan-African diaspora, and in particular, some of the political, economic, and social, and self-determined issues that are taking place on the mother continent of Africa. We want to remind you to continue to support the New Black Panther Party by going to our website at www.nbpp.org. You can click that site to join. You can also click the donate button in order to help keep this broadcast going, as well as support the humanitarian efforts of the New Black Panther Party, in addition to our freedom fighting efforts that we have done and continue to do. So again, there's one spot to do all of those things, and that's nbpp.org. So without any further ado, tonight's broadcast, Make Africa Great. This is a rebroadcast of weekly programming on this network. Black Power.
And so the topic for you to tackle is the urgent need for African unity, continental integration, and pooling resources from the diaspora, which is your forte.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I would like to thank Professor Lumumba for putting this incredible program together. My brother, Dr. Adam, is. May I give you a shout out? You waved at me. And all the other participants and the organizers of this incredible program. What's happening here today is needed now more than ever. The status of Africa, the death of George Floyd reminded us once more that while a lot has changed, very little has actually changed. So when you look at what happened to George Floyd, you begin to realize that as black people, we have been the most loyal race to the white race, starting with when the settlers came to Africa, and followed by a couple of hundred years later, taking our children into slavery across the Atlantic, where our children built Europe, they built the United States, all along while being abused and tortured and raped and lynched. The atrocities are unbelievable and completely endless. When you analyze our status as black people, we have been the most subservient race. And the question then becomes, when you realize that what happened to George Floyd was just the tip of the iceberg, that this is something that's been going on for centuries, while they may have stopped lynching us, even though that looks like it's coming back again, because we had a couple of young men now, maybe five young men, who have been found hanging from trees since George Floyd died. That's here in the United States. They are claiming it's suicide. I'm not sure why these young men would suddenly decide to lynch, to hang themselves, one of them pretty close to the courthouse. But be it as it may, we are reminded once more that if we do not come together and speak with one voice, this is going to continue. It is really plain and simple. The abuse of black people around the world, the disrespect of black people around the world is going to continue. You know, the West has been bullying us for far too long, and we have been submissive. In spite of all that, what saddens me the most is how we remain so loyal to the white race. Now we are getting educated, and we are getting educated so we can continue to serve their purposes. It is something that I wonder, at what point are we black people at some point sit down and have a conversation with image in the mirror to say, are we going to continue on the path that we are on? We are currently riding somebody else's train, and this train is implementing their agenda. It is going in their direction, serving their purpose. Our train should be going in the opposite direction, implementing our agenda and serving our purpose. when are we going to get off somebody else's train and jump onto our own train? The reality is, what we have been doing as a race, the self-hate, the disrespect and distrust of each other. Sometimes I feel like I'm more disrespected when I'm among my own than when I'm with others, simply because we have this inherent self-hate. When is that all going to end? As I live in this beautiful country of the United States, I can't help but observe what other races are doing. You look at the unity among the Chinese diaspora. No black man can open a shop in Chinatown. You look at the unity among the Italian, American Italian. No one can, no black man can open a shop in Little Italy. The unity among the Indians in a city like Dallas. Indians from India have not built their own neighborhoods with their own schools. And yet we black people are still very proud to be the only black person in a neighborhood, as if it's some kind of badge of honor. That's how much we don't like ourselves. Except we don't realize that when you don't trust the next black person, guess what? They don't trust you either. And then the next person doesn't trust the next person. So we've been at a perpetual stalemate of stupidity, really. Why can't we learn from the other races? And I use an example of the Jews. There are only 15 million Jews in the diaspora, and they own a very little bitty country called Israel. And they're the most powerful race on earth. Then contrast that with us Africans. There are about 1.7 billion Africans on earth, 1.3 on the continent, and about 400 million around the globe. And we own the largest landmass on earth, over 30,000 kilometers. Square kilometers of landmass, with the richest natural resources, and yet we are considered the poorest. And the reason is because we are not united. When the Jews realized that they are endangered after what Hitler did to them, they found out that their strength was in their unity. They came together. They started looking inward. They started pulling their pennies together. So they went from being endangered to being the most powerful race by simply believing in each other, realizing that I may not like you as an individual, but when it comes to Israel, they stuck together like super glue. It's a natural thing. It's a natural affinity. That's what is normal. But we black people, we have been brainwashed to dislike ourselves, to not love ourselves. We've been programmed to believe that black was bad, black was ugly. I usually take it back growing up in my native country of Zimbabwe. Prior to the British coming to Zimbabwe, we did not know about the color black and the color white. But they came with their Christianity, with their religion, and the missionaries told us that the manner in which we practiced our religion was bad and backwards and undesirable, that we have to adopt their form of worship. So they told us about the angels. And they said the angels are white and that Jesus Christ was white. And then everything beautiful and desirable was white. You were white to get married. Even angels' food cake is white. And then they turn around, this is the real kicker. They said, now you look at me, we too are white. What's most interesting is when you take a piece of paper that is white, I never seen a white person who looks like a white piece of paper. But they said, never mind how I look. We are white and we represent the angels and we represent Jesus. We're the image of Jesus. We're the image of the angels. And then they turned around and they told us about the devil. And they said, the devil is black. And they said, the devil is a horrible being. The devil does all bad deeds. Everything black is bad. You wear black to go to funerals. And then they turn around. Oh, yes. And the devil's food cake is even black. And then they turn around and they say, oh, by the way, even though you don't look exactly black, you too are black. Now come to church and let's worship images that do not look like you. So since the missionaries came to Africa. We Africans have been worshiping images that do not look like us. We Africans have been admiring images that we will never be, worshiping angels with the color that we will never be. Except that was all a lie. The reality is, who has seen the angels? Who has seen the devils? Nobody. We were just blatantly lied to. And guess what? We just accepted it. We never questioned it. We never said, by the way, who went to heaven and came back? It was all designed to criminalize our race. It was a plan. It was somebody else's strategy. What saddens me is we are in 2020. We are in the 21st century. The white men came to Africa over 600 years ago, and we have never questioned that. May I table that, in my humble opinion, until we undo the damage at a very deep level that was done to us, until we understand that we were lied to, we were simply lied to. In my village, being an angel or being beautiful was based on deeds. Being a devil or being ugly was based on deeds. What that police officer did on the streets of Minneapolis, he is the devil incarnate. That's how we must understand life and get out of this train that is full of nothing but lies about our blackness. And until we understand that we are the origin of humanity. We are the origin of humanity. Without the black woman, there wouldn't be any other race on earth. That is a fact. And you can take it to the bank. Why then are we being demoralized and painted as the scum of the earth? You see, you got to understand that a bully does what the bully does because they themselves insecure.
Right.
We are indestructible as a black race. And that scares some on this earth, on this world. So at what point are we going to begin to understand ourselves as black people, as Africans, and begin to say we are just as good as anybody else, and that we have been lied to for centuries, and that we must also accept that we have been stupid enough for so long that we have accepted the lie, taken it hook, line, and sinker. Well, that game is up. It's got to change. And the onus is on you and I. We, the elders, at this age, we have let our children down. We have failed to teach them the truth. We have failed to wake up from our slumber of many years, of centuries. Well, the time is now. In our Africa, the African Continental Free Trade Area is going to be implemented come next year. The reality is, we are the richest continent on earth. We are the continent with everything and anything the world could ever need. And if we do not come together, if we do not wake up from our slumber, guess what's getting ready to happen? The Europeans have been coming to Africa for centuries, and they are getting ready to move in this time in a bigger way. The Chinese may not have been coming to Africa as long as the Europeans have, but they too are just waiting. You see what's going to happen with the African Continental Free Trade Area? You can now establish yourself in one country and spread like wildfire through all the continent. The boundaries that have been slowing them from moving across the continent are now being melted away. They're harmonizing their policies, trade policies. All the non-tariff barriers are getting removed. All that is being done for the benefit of the Africans, not the outsiders.
Thank you.
But here's the reality. If we do not unite as the African diaspora and take up that seat that has our name, if we do not unite and understand that the Chinese are waiting, ready to quadruple their presence in Africa, the Europeans are ready to quadruple their presence in Africa, they have not only a one-year plan, not a 10-year plan, not a 30-year plan, but a 100-year plan on how to recolonize Africa.
Thank you very much.
You see, let me conclude by saying, as the African diaspora, we have a very important role to play. And our role is to occupy that seat in Africa that we must fill in order to stop our heads of state from giving contracts to the Chinese and to the Europeans. And until we move in with our expertise, that is because of the brain drain that Africa does not have the capacity that Africa needs, which is why the outsiders are coming in, Africa is going to be gone for good. So to the African diaspora, I'm saying, you have a responsibility to unite. You have a responsibility to go and take that seat on the continent that has your name. The continental development agenda must be driven by black people, must be driven by the Africans. If we do not get on that seat, it will be a sad day when you have to go to Africa and a Chinaman takes you to Africa and a European man takes you to Africa. A Japanese takes you to Africa. No, that cannot be. And we must all stand up together and say no to continuous exploitation of Africa. We must unite. The continental development agenda of Africa will be driven by the children of Africa. Those who want to come into Africa, they have to come behind us. That can only happen when we unite. I thank you.
Women across the continent, in Europe, in the Caribbean, and we are here because we have recognized that are going forward, we must unite. You may or may not know, but on the 17th day of July, the Africa Diaspora Institute, founded by Dr. Arikana Chiombri-Kwao, will be launched virtually. And our intention is to raise $17 billion. Our good friend in the United States of America in Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Rosenthal, wants to create a bank from which young men and women can borrow funds and engage in agriculture, engage in technology, so that young entrepreneurs in the education sector, such as Kelvin Kaunda, can be leaders in education, so that young women such as Shamil, who are already demonstrating the ability to disseminate to the world, Nkumbi, the young Ture, and many whom I cannot mention, men and women who are dedicated in their own right, can move this agenda forward. I have no doubt in my mind that we are up to a good thing. The beauty of the moment is that Africa has now recognized that her only salvation not only requires but demands that she pulls herself up by her bootstraps. The beauty of the moment is that this time round, we have boots and we have laces and we can therefore pull ourselves up. I have no doubt that it can be done. And you young men who are assembled here, you are the people to do it. When I see the continent of Africa represented here, in its splendor and in its entirety, from the arts to the sciences, I look forward to the day when our taxis in Bissau, in Guinea-Bissau, will not be operated from the United States of America via Uber or from Estonia via Bolt. But there shall be a technology in Bangui, in Central African Republic, that is doing that. I look forward to that day. I look forward to the day when we shall have our equivalent of Zoom, which is operated out of Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it's you who are going to do it. I look forward to the day when, as my good friend Dr. Folefak said, the environment is so rich and so enabling that our men and women who are in the diaspora will work with us and be in other parts of the world, not because the environment is hostile and toxic, but because we too must work beyond our frontiers. I look forward to that day. And I have no doubt in my mind that you constitute the necessary ingredients. So today, if there is anything that you must gather from this conversation, is that we must exercise the ghost of inferiority complex and re-energize ourselves by embracing the reality that we are great and that we have the ability to do that which we ought to do. It is the great Tanzanian President Julius Kambarage Nyerere who said, and I can't agree with him more, it can be done. Play your part. History has demonstrated not once, not twice, but times without number, that those who seek in earnest actually gain what they desire. Today I ask you to seek in earnest. History has demonstrated once again that those who identify their goals and pursue them with the delicacy of a sleepwalker finally reach their destination. Today I urge you to remember these famous words of the great Nigerian poet and writer, Wole Soyinka. A man dies in you if you have not discovered that which you can do for the benefit of the society. And when he said that a tiger does not shout about his tigritude, no, it pounces. You follow the path of a tiger and you see the skeleton of an antelope and you know that some tigritude has emanated there. So those of you who are in Botswana, in Haverone, I want to come to Haverone and see what you have done, and I'll know that some tigritude has emanated there. If you are in Bangui, I want to come to Bangui, and I want to see the skeleton of a dika, and I'll know that some tigritude has emanated there. For the great writers are still right. All the world is but a stage. We have our comings and goings. Each one of us playing multiple roles. Ask you now what role you are playing. And once you have identified that role, go out into the world and do that which is good and right. There'll be no shortage of critics whose only claim to fame is to fault find. Ignore them. You cannot throw stones at every dog that barks. Ignore them. Kwame Nkrumah was right. We look neither left nor right. We look forward in the hope that we shall achieve. And achieve we will. May God bless you all. Go you now into the world and serve the world in humility, passion, and dedication. May it be well with you.
Thank you so much, Professor, for those words of encouragement. I'm not sure if you're available to... Okay.
Fine, proceed.
Thank you. Okay. So I was wondering, okay, are you able to hear me from your side?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So, Prof, I was wondering if you're available to take on three questions from the youth here before we wrap it up, before we go.
Yes, perfectly.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Prof, for that. I would like to take them two by two because there's so many of them, but we can't do all of them at a go. So, Kahonde Moisi is saying that what were the main problems which challenged Pan-Africanism that caused the founding fathers not to unite Africa? He said that this is because when he's reading the works of different founders, such as Kwame Nkrumah, Marcus Garvey, these people were too hot-headed to unite Africa, but he has never understood what were the problems that made them not to unite. That's the first question. And then the other question comes from Los Angeles, And he is saying, this gentleman is saying that, would you, Professor Lumumba, and Her Excellency Ambassador Rikana Chihombori-Kwao, be willing to view an economic funding plan to perpetually finance the continental and diaspora Pan-African reunion?
Thank you. So can I take those?
Yes, sir. You can take those, and then I will come back with the next set.
Thank you very much. I'll start by answering the second question, which is more practical. I have already indicated that on the 17th day of July, the Africa Diaspora Institute will be launched virtually. It is the brainchild of Dr. Harry Kana, and she has put together an advisory board with membership that is drawn from all continents where Africans reside. And the intention of that particular institute is to create an environment where funds will be raised, and these funds will then be available and be accessed by young men and women for the purposes of undertaking entrepreneurship in their chosen areas. We are also working very closely with Dr. Rosenthal, who has been moving across the continent. In fact, when COVID struck, he was himself marooned in the Cameroon for almost 3 months, and people are out there. So in direct answer to your question, that is already being done. But we are not naive. We recognize that there are existing institutions, and that we cannot ignore these institutions, and therefore we are making efforts to ensure that we work with the African Union and the African Development Bank. We hope that Dr. Akinwumi Adesina will be re-elected, and we will work with these institutions to ensure that we create this environment where young men and women will have access to funds. So I can confirm to you that efforts are not being made. But Tausi Swedi said something that is very critical. Just like a big ocean liner cannot turn suddenly, sometimes these things do not happen as dramatically as you would desire. So a little patience is necessary. There will be many hurdles, but as long as we keep up the spirit, then it will be well with us. And it gives me an opportunity simply to explain to you, as I go into the second question, is why is African unity not as easy as we would desire? One can take you to 1884 to Berlin, the very arbitrary manner in which Africa was subdivided as spheres of influence. In fact, one would say, hunting grounds for the European powers, European tribes. If it was not the Portuguese, it was the Spaniards or the Belgians or the Germans. They simply sliced Africa. And when they were driven out of the continent was designed to fail. Every African country that was granted independence, that seized independence, was designed to fail. Look at Nigeria, which was administered as Northern Nigeria and Southern and Eastern Nigeria. On the eve of independence, you put them together suddenly in the hope that there will be so much conflict that they cannot survive. Look at Cameroon, the same thing. Look at Sudan, administered separately as Arab North and African South. On the eve of independence, you put them together. Look at Rwanda, Burundi. It was always that design. And that is why when the struggle for independence gained traction, Kwame Nkrumah was very clear. Kwame Nkrumah, and he held a number of meetings in 1958, a meeting in Accra, Ghana, at which he said, if we do not unite, our colonizers are going to ensure that we are in so much conflict that we will never unite. They'll make sure that we are fighting one another because our division is in their best interest. and the speech that he gave in Casablanca, Morocco, about African unity is what then created what is normally called the Casablanca Group. The Casablanca Group was the group of heads of state who believed that Africa should unite immediately. But the foreign powers created another group, which was led by Félix Houphouët-Boigny of Côte d'Ivoire and William Tubman of Liberia, normally referred to as the Monrovia Group. So when the African, the 32 heads of state and governments, which were free at that time, met in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on the 24th and 25th days of May 1963, there were two groups, the Casablanca Group, led by Kwame Nkrumah, and at that time, some of those who supported him included Ahmed Sekou Touré of Guinea, Modibo Keita of Mali, and of course, Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. On the other side, there were people like Houphouët-Boigny, David Dacko, and others. Nkrumah, and you must read his speech, said, we must live here with one government, with one currency, with one army, because if we don't, we will be divided. He lost. And that is why the Organization of African Unity was created as a loose alliance. And remember, at that time, the French were very active with their former colonies. They were creating the organization of French-speaking countries. The British were active with their Commonwealth. And of course, everybody, the Belgians were equally active. And apartheid South Africa was still alive and well. The Rhodesia was still under colonial tutelage. The Portuguese were still in Angola, Guinea-Bissau, Cabo Verde, and Mozambique, and the South Africans were still in Namibia, and Southwest African Republic, and the Spaniards were in Saharawi. So it is that makes African unity very difficult, because the people then got used to their sovereignties. That is why in the year 2001, Muammar al-Gaddafi, to his credit, in Sirte, said we must reform the Organization of African Unity and make it something that will bring us together. And that is why you then had the adoption of the African Unity in Durban, South Africa in 2002. And progressively, but with difficulties, we are now saying under Agenda 2063 and African Continental Free Trade Area that we must now begin to move. But I want to remind you of a speech, and then I conclude my answer. This speech was delivered on the 6th day of March 1997 by Julius Kambarage Nyerere of Tanzania on the 40th occasion of the celebration of Ghanaian independence. He said, Nkrumah was right, we were wrong. Had we listened to Nkrumah, all these coup d'etats and all these wars in Africa would not have been there. We would be united, we would have other difficulties. Now that we know that Nkrumah was right, it is your duty as young people to carry that gospel. It is not going to be easy. The unity we desire may not even be achieved in your lifetime. But let us keep up the struggle. African Americans will tell you that perhaps the African Americans who are present in 1800 and on the day of the Emancipation Proclamation, they may have thought that the African Americans were free. But 100 years later, in 1963, they could not even have the right to vote. And only last week you saw in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a white man with his knees on the neck of an African-American, George Floyd. The man saying, I can't breathe. There are so many things, metaphorically speaking, that are still on the neck of an African. We can't breathe. We can't breathe, our economies can't breathe, our agriculture can't breathe, our technology can't breathe. We can't breathe. So if the death of George Floyd was emblematic of our situation, our duty now is to rise up, and it shall be well with us. It is not for the faint-hearted. It is for those who are prepared to give it their all. But it shall be well with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Prof. Thank you so much. So next we have Kofji Kiprotich, who is from Kenya, and he's saying, how can Africans be liberated from self-hate? Language barriers in Africa are still influencing cross-border interactions. What should the youth do to improve cross-border interactions? He's taking, for example, Mozambique and Tanzania. And then to also to couple it with a question from Dr. Owen from PGWRC Church in Uganda, is saying, is there any means of bringing our voices louder and more practical by producing anything that will be visual? I think he's speaking to the issue of technology.
But let me answer those as the last questions. I know people are tired. But let me start with the first one. I think a lot is happening. One of the things that I've learned during this COVID period is that Africans are doing amazing things within the continent. And I'm sure some of you know that. And Africans are doing amazing things even outside of the continent. The very fact that we have the young member of parliament from Barbados, there are Africans who do not even know that there is a country called Barbados. But we now have people from Barbados are with us doing great things. Monica will tell you in Uganda, the Makerere University has produced a solar bus, which is now flying the route of Kampala. Even in technology, that is happening. In Rwanda, they are assembling robots. Things are happening. We are now talking about dams and the generation of electricity. So even within a forum such as this, there are many things that are happening. And we are already beginning to interact with governments. And governments are beginning to listen to us. Because you must be present at the dinner table in order for your portion to be considered. And I think that that is what we are doing. So a lot of things are happening at a very practical level, and I'm very happy about that. The language barrier, there is one thing that Chinua Achebe once said. He said that the English have stolen so much from Africa, but there is only one thing that we have stolen from them, their language. And we are now using it to good effect. And I think that the languages that we learn from the the erstwhile colonizers, we have now, English is now so Africanized in many ways. We use our idioms and proverbs and only use their words. But the truth is, we have now adopted, the African Union has now adopted Kiswahili as a lingua franca for Africa. I look to the forward to the day that it will be taught in South Africa, and the South Africans are already teaching Kiswahili, and that it will be taught in the Gambia, and that it will be taught in Senegal and in Sierra Leone. And in any event, language in and of itself cannot be a dividing factor. When the Europeans came into the continent of Africa, they were speaking their language, and we were speaking their language. They ended up conquering us. So language is not an excuse. In Europe, the European Union have 27 working languages. So that is not an issue. Where human beings have the spirit of doing good. Language cannot be a barrier. The great Kenyan political scientist, Professor Ali Mazurui, once said that where you people see the Tower of Babel, I can only see the power of Babel. And I think that there is a power in our diversity. There is power in our heterogeneity. And I have no doubt in my mind today, we have met on this website young men and women from across 38 African countries with representation from 10 non-African countries. We communicated, and even those who did not have the opportunity to speak, there was a spirit that emanated amongst us. Don't worry. Once we make the solemn vow that we are going to do the right thing, we shall tear down these boundaries. We shall no longer need visas to go to African countries. It's coming, and I dare say that it's going to come in our lifetimes. Thank you.
The theme for this conference today is redefining Pan-Africanism, the role of youth. And right now we'll be delving into the African Free Trade Agreement, seeing what opportunities are in there for us as young people and as Africans, both in the continent and the diaspora. Miss Charity, are you ready?
I'd like you to unmute. I'm trying to unmute. Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, sorry for that mishap. It was indicating to me that the host is not allowing the participant to unmute. So I was trying really to struggle. So I don't know. So greetings to everyone. Sawubona, Bondia, Mulibwanji, all the African youth that are on this platform. I'm so delighted to actually be given this opportunity by my good professor, Professor Lumumba, who actually is my big brother and a good friend. And I'm also delighted to actually share this platform that many of you youths will also be hearing from one of my role models and admire Ambassador Arikana. It's such an excited and blessed day. So given the time that I'm given, I'm going to be speaking briefly on the African Continental Free Trade Agreement and how you as young people, particularly those that are aspiring to be entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs, can benefit from this trade agreement. Now, when Professor Lumumba actually requested me to actually present on this topic, I was reminded of a case of one young lady from Namibia, in my country here, that actually wanted to export some products. Actually, she had actually some products that she wanted to export to one of the African countries. But the feasibility study has shown that obviously she could be able to actually penetrate that market. But because of the import tariffs in that kind of market, obviously it was not going to be feasible. The next example was also of a young lady in Botswana. She also had a very, very brilliant business that's going on there. She produces honey and byproducts of honey such as beeswax and cosmetics. And she was informed from the feasibility study that she could actually get a very good market in West and Eastern Africa. But that was not feasible as well because of the high import tariffs that were actually in most countries. So many of you would actually relate to those kinds of challenges that doing trade within Africa is not that easy. It's costly, and I think the free trade agreement is exactly what it's trying to address. What is it in this trade agreement for young people? This agreement actually is to create a single market for African economies, meaning that the movement of goods and people and labor could actually be more easily facilitated. I was actually looking at the time of COVID 2019, what was actually happening now, where many countries actually called for a state of emergency. And when many countries called for a state of emergency, there were a lot of regulations that had to be put in place to ensure that, you know, the state takes control during that time. And what was actually very saddening was I'm blessed that I have a lot of networks throughout the globe on the continent. And the first thing I was asking many of my friends around the continent was, when your country has actually gone in a state of emergency, do you have any street kids there? They said no. Many governments were able to actually immediately, you know, find resolve to ensure that these street kids were actually put elsewhere. And I looked at all these periods, what was happening in all these economies during the lockdown. First of all, we could actually prove that indeed, as Africans, as the world, we can actually live in peace. That was one underlying fact. Secondly, it also proved to us that obviously it is very difficult, even as much as you are in isolation, that you cannot live without each other. So I was able to see so many of the governments that were trying to immediately put in place emergency regulations that would actually allow for the free facilitation of goods and services, especially essential goods, during that time. Now, if we were able to do that during this natural disaster, during this time of COVID, what is actually stopping us as Africans to be able to actually implore those kinds of measures during a time that Africa needs that? I was actually, 2 days ago, we hosted a business meeting here in Namibia, and one of my good friend entrepreneurs was trying to actually define what does it mean to actually have a state of emergency, and briefly defined, it's a situation of natural danger or disaster in which a government suspends normal constitutional procedures in order to gain control. Now, looking at Africa, does Africa really have control at the moment? We have high levels of poverty in Africa. The African child wakes up every day to hopelessness. The African youth wakes up every day to hopelessness. But maybe it's about time that we should not just have state of emergencies in individual countries. Maybe it's about time that the African leaders, when they meet in the African Union, should actually be speaking about a state of continental emergency in Africa, because that is very critical. When we can do that, we will be able to actually make sure that we put in places to actually implement this African Continental Free Trade Agreement. For example, right now, you will find that there are as many economies that are blessed, you know, with fertile, you know, land, and they're doing well with agricultural produce. Trade within Africa is actually very low at the moment. You'll find that many African states, it's very evident, they trade more with other continental, I mean, with other economies in Europe or in America, because it's very convenient. It's easy for you to be able to transport a product from Africa to those other Western worlds conveniently. But just to trade within Africa, it is so cumbersome. If you want to actually transport your tomatoes from West Africa down to Southern Africa, by the time they get to their markets, those tomatoes will actually be, you know, almost fertilizer. So what we are saying in this agreement that many economies will have to actually do a lot of structural adjustments, infrastructure development, improvement of actually of skills within the continent, so that we are able to trade with each other freely. Now, I was asking quite a number of youth, not just in my country, but in other countries where I say it. Have you ever heard about the African Continental Free Trade Agreement? And if I have to pose this question, even among the youth that are participating on this platform today, how many of you have even seen that agreement? Some of you that are aspiring to be actually entrepreneurs, how many of you have actually read and seen what that agreement entails? And that's exactly the mindset that I want the youth of today to actually be able to actually align themselves to. That when governments are making rules, or they're making actually ascending to any of these instruments that have actually an impact on your future as an African youth, what is your role in there? Because that agreement, it provides, of course, to make sure that the youth of this continent can actually take up their space, become very innovative, allow for competition of this kind of actual activity that you are doing in order to develop Africa. Now, I have seen that there are a lot of some challenges within this African with this agreement. In many economies, I don't think many of the youth actually have the information about it. So it's about time that many African governments, you as young entrepreneurs, implore on your governments that they give you as much information. When they go to these meetings and speak about this agreement, how many of them can come back to their economies and gather their youth and even actually prepare them how well they can actually be able to participate and benefit from this agreement? The second thing that many of our African youth, of course, that actually they actually are challenged with is the issue of access to finance. Obviously, for this agreement to actually be implemented and for the youth to benefit from it, many governments have to make sure that they put policies and instruments in place that will make, you know, entrepreneurship easy for many of our youth to have access to finance, to be supported, to be mentored, and be able to actually, you know, make inroads in this market. The other thing that Africa is actually challenged with is the issue of education. If you look at the levels of literacy rates in many African countries, not just education, but also training, many youth are aspiring to go into to being entrepreneurs. But how well trained and how mentored are they? So I am very excited that the TLO Mumurumba Foundation has that pact within its program to really mentor many of these African youth. And I encourage many of you that whenever these programs are there, please make sure that you participate, because there is no way you can be able to actually access or be able to make it in the entrepreneurship world or in the world of business if you're not properly mentored, you're not well prepared. There's a lot of innovation around the globe. And what has COVID actually taught us? It has taught us that as Africans, this is about the time that we need to make sure that we really enhance the trade among ourselves. The issue of tariffs in many African states is really hampering trade, and that's exactly what this African trade agreement is trying to address. The issue of ensuring that governments can actually put in policies that will promote industrialization in most of our states, this is exactly what the agreement is trying to actually address. But I'm actually cautious of making sure that I also implore on the young people, what responsibilities do you need to actually undertake to ensure that this agreement also benefits you? If you look at what has been happening within our regions, particularly in the past years, you'll find that our mindset is still actually aligned to think that fellow African is actually a foreigner. We have seen issues of a lot of homophobic attacks that have actually been happening. If you're talking about integration, because that's exactly where this agreement is aligned to ensure the integration of Africa, to ensure that Africa has its own identity, to ensure that Africa has its own ethics in the way it does business with the world. So as young people, when these things are actually happening and you see a fellow brother as a foreigner, how then are you able to make sure that you realize that integration of Africa? It's very, very critical that as young people, when you try to also express your anger in the things that you want your leaders to actually pay attention to, be careful about the decisions that you make and the actions that you do. I would want to see an African youth that will implement this African continental trade area by making sure that when you are addressing issues, you don't go and ban a building, because it will take you another 20 years to be able to develop that. But instead, I want to see an African youth that can be able to probably round up these leaders and say, today, we are going to make sure that we spend the night with you in the slums, in the court, so that you feel how this court is. And when they go back to parliament, they're able to make decisions. So it's very critical that you as an African youth, instead of looking, look at ways that you can make sure that you call your governments to order. If the agreement is actually providing a lot of opportunities there and what governments are supposed to be doing, this is a time for you as an African youth. How do you redefine and make sure that you can actually create a history that the next generation can actually refer to? In this year, 6 years on, I want to quote the namesake of my professor here, Professor Rumba, when he said in 1960, African unity and solidarity are no longer dreams. They must be expressed in decisions. That was a statement that was made 60 years ago. So the unity of Africa was not something that only started at the time that this African Continental Free Trade was actually being negotiated. It started long ago by our forefathers, our own leaders. 60 years on, what has Africa actually done? What is very critical for you to understand in this agreement is that you as young people need to prepare yourself well, skillfully, because it will mean that any person from Namibia, from DRC, from Nigeria, from Zimbabwe, can be able to actually move freely and actually trade. But within your own spaces, how much have you prepared yourself in terms of scaling up your potential, in terms of making sure that whatever you're doing, you're able to do that competitively? Because many of us, when they trade within their own space, you know, for example, you don't actually apply a lot of innovation within yourself because you don't have competition. So with this agreement, it will mean definitely a lot of competition. And what does it hold for us? It is indicated that by the year 2030, at least this is actually able to bring almost, if well implemented, to bring at least a combined GDP of over $1 trillion. So what should that mean for an African youth? That should mean that you have to open up your minds, change your mindset in making sure that while you meet on platforms like this, what type of information are you able to exchange among yourselves? What type of interrogations are you supposed to make sure that you take with your governments? In many states, when some of you actually go into many of these states, you see that many countries are really doing quite well. In Namibia, I can actually probably tell you that definitely when it comes to our logistics sector, in many of our infrastructure development, things are happening. But there are also loopholes. When you actually want to think that you want to trade within an African country, you as youth, you must have platforms where you call your leaders to perform. You will be able to tell them, If it is very difficult for us to trade within our nation, how are we able to compete fairly with other nations when we open up for trade? So make sure that as young people, assert your position, take that pride. In many economies, when you go and trade, whether it's in China, whether it's in US, they have got ethics of doing business with those economies. Can we actually be able to see an Africa where we have ways of doing business with Africa? That's exactly what this Continental Free Trade Agreement will try to address. When we will have a continental customs union where all African states can be able to benefit from and make sure that they develop their economies. You, the youth, are the ones that must put your voice in there. You must make sure that you prepare yourself skillfully, you prepare yourself actually innovatively, and be able to interact with each other and not see each other as a brother and see each other as a foreigner, and see each other as a foreigner because somebody came from Zimbabwe and comes to Namibia and you see them as the person as a foreigner. And we have to remind ourselves, by the way, that the African continent, all these borders were actually colonial borders that were created by us. And it's about time that you, the youth of this current generation, 20, 50 years from now, what history can actually be referred back to you when actually your own generation has to speak about what you have actually done for your continent. So I believe that this trade agreement, if well implemented, again, I want to reemphasize that, if well implemented, and that well implementation will only happen if we as a youth of this generation can take up our space and take our leaders to action. During this COVID time, I would believe that many of the youth that are actually on this platform should be able to push in their governments, particularly those that have not yet ratified that agreement. This is the time that you actually have supposed to actually be questioning them, that look, we have seen how it has actually done when COVID came. Borders were closed. Some of the countries that actually had not so much of the products and services, the essentials they required, they needed to import them. And because structural issues that we have within our borders among our African continent, it was actually very difficult. It's been very difficult to get these essentials on time. So it's very important that we as African youth, when we actually engage our leaders, these are some of the things that we need to interrogate. Take a tick box as African youth where you have to tell your leaders that we say that this agreement is supposed to be having implemented already in July this year. Now, COVID came, is a step backwards. What are you doing as a youth in terms of making sure that your leaders are actually fast-tracking the implementation of this agreement? Not just that, how are they actually implementing structures within your respective economies to ensure that they will be able to make this agreement actually a reality? Now, on touching on that, I would like to actually remind us that even as African entrepreneurs that want to see the integration of Africa, let us also be mindful that we do not make the mistakes of what our own leaders have actually made. We have seen how many of our economies have actually been put in a state of devastation because of the kind of decisions that some of our leaders have actually made. As young people, train yourself and understand that you've got a responsibility to make Africa the what you want actually it to be. Make sure that you conduct your business ethically. We should not actually be seeing the kind of business of this young generation that is actually based on brown envelopes at the table. But what we want to see is an African youth that will not just be quoting how Singapore made it, but an African youth that takes action in implementing how Singapore actually did it. And I want to actually applaud what is happening in Rwanda. When can we actually be able to see an African youth that will say, instead of me actually relocating to go to the UK, UK relocating to go to Asia, I can actually think I can go to Rwanda because something is actually happening there. You will see even after COVID, many of these economies will try to actually make beautiful, well-appetizing conferences with a COVID name in there, that these conferences are actually there for us to actually go and get funding actually there. And our African leaders, some of them, will be actually backing their backs because of the SMEs that you want to get there and you want to go there. Why can we not just be demanding to ensure that with this African Continental Free Trade Agreement, we should be able to actually put up infrastructure where we are the ones that now actually call the shots and tell these people, this conference is going to happen in Africa. We are going to demand that this kind of gathering also take place in Africa. And these people can come to Africa and bring opportunities to be able for them to actually appreciate our tourism, our landscape, and bring investments that really can actually change the lives of our people. In this agreement, then it provides you as a youth to be able to dictate and guide what type of investment you'd like to see actually in your own economies. That is very, very critical. Let's not just sit and actually, we should be able to welcome investors. There's no way we can work in isolation. But let us also direct the kind of investment that we want to see in our own continent. and not just investment that will make sure that they take out our own people on the streets. We have seen so many of these activities that have done, and they come very competitively. In the end, they actually take our own youth out of business. Let us make sure that with the coming and implementation into force of this content, should we see a consortium of youth that can be able to build a bridge in Kigali? Should we see a consortium of African youth entrepreneurs that can be able to actually build a road in Sudan that is built by our own youth, our own African entrepreneurs, and also not actually be able to be dependent on other economies? We can do it because Africa has those resources, and Africa needs to prepare itself skillfully. And you, the youth, you've got that key to ensure that you drive the agenda of Africa. Agenda 2063 is not going to be implemented by those people that actually signed it. It's going to be implemented, and it's going to actually experience. It's going to actually be seen by you, the youth of this time. It's about time that you have to make sure that you take your space. Take your space in preparing yourself well, that you can be able to partake in the benefits that come with this integration. The integration has to change our mindset in the way we do things, in the way we interact with each other, in the way we do business, even our cultural setup. It should not actually hinder us. Our cultural difference should not actually hinder us from integrating, but should actually bring us together in making sure that we can develop the continent that we want to see. So, in actually concluding, I hope I'm still within my time. Am I still within my time? Can you?
Yes, you are. Just two more minutes.
All right. In my 2 minutes, I would like to actually conclude with this. Also, another quote that comes from my favorite professor. The youth are the barometers of the political and economic climate of any country. Therefore, take your pride and your peace. I would like to see a youth movement that will actually be interrogating the implementation of these instruments that our leaders signed. Not an African youth and be territorial and be protective about their own territories, but an African youth that is definitely wanting to integrate, share skills, exchange ideas on how you can actually develop the Africa that you want. That continental free trade agreement, as it is said, will be actually the largest trade free trade area after the WTO, which was actually implemented in 1994. Looking at the population that Africa has, many youth will actually have an opportunity to be able to build their own Africa. And I believe that through the many programs that you partake, particularly the PLO Lumumba Foundation Mentorship Program, I urge many of the youth to continue actually participating in this program. There are so many things that you can actually learn and exchange from. It's a pity that, you know, with the new normal, we are actually now meant to be speaking this way. I'm somebody that always likes to be demonstrative when I'm actually doing my presentation, but we'll adapt next time for the sake of time. So I want to really thank my good friend Professor for having accorded me this time to be able to actually share my ideas on how this actually can happen and how you, as the youth, can really make sure that you partake in the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade and how it can actually benefit you. This is meant to make sure that Africa takes its place. We need to see a lot of trade among African nations, because I think, apart from COVID, the poverty that is already there in Africa is a lot much that we as Africans should be able to be concerned. Poverty is a disease. It's a disease that is even more than cancer, and I hate poverty. None of us would want to see actually any African child actually dying of poverty just because of the decisions that we make. So let's make sure that in our ways that we are doing after this conference, I would like to see that the next forums that we come in, can I hear a youth consortium that was able to actually come together, and they were able to make sure that they implemented ideas that would foster the integration of Africa?
Yeah, all my mentors who are the young people, I like to flip the switch. Sometimes we think we're coming here to mentor you, but you are the ones that are mentoring us, because the older I get, the younger my teachers become. So, and I have hope in Africa. So as you hear, I'm here at the James Cancer Center. I'm a researcher, I'm an oncologist, and I'm an educator. So I wear those three hats. And like you, I once sat in the places where you people are in Africa and trained there. And I had hope then that somebody had this initiative to really have mentored some of us, because I've had to learn some of the things myself the hard way. But we're here, and that's what the world is actually meant to be, so that as we go, you guys can come and stand on our shoulders and learn where we failed, and then stand on, take on our successes and build from there. So that said, my topic is about healthcare, but I want to So I would actually start by challenging your thinking, you know, so I start with making some provocations or some things that are on which are like my predicate for this talk. So healthcare is a fundamental human right, and that's, we should establish that from off the bat. And as such, if it's a fundamental human right, it means, therefore, that when considering healthcare, we need to think about the least of us, not really just the most, you know, not just the highest amongst us when we're developing such healthcare system, so that people, anybody can access it irrespective of their social or economic status. And I would say, if you think about it that way, then what I would call the three evils of society today, which are namely social injustice, economic deprivation, and denialism or anti-science, are complete antithesis of a good healthcare system. And therefore, and the next thing I want to provoke you to think about is that healthcare is actually economy. In America, where I live and work, the healthcare system, you know, actually accounts for about 25% of the United States economy. And, you know, 19% of America's GDP is spent on healthcare. We'll talk a little bit about where Africa stands in that. And therefore, healthcare is equal to, I mean, a good healthcare is economic, the same as economic health. So you cannot separate those two. The next thing that I want to provoke you to think about is that the world has become a global village. Back in the 1400s, when the plague, actually, or the Black Death, as it was called in Europe, first broke out and ravaged Europe for over four centuries, it took 3 winters. That means about 3 years to go across tiny little Europe. But in 2002, the first SARS outbreak took 3 days, you know, to go from one continent to the rest of the continent in the world. Three. And I'm sure that SARS-CoV-2, when we actually look at it, think about it and look at it, it would have taken probably roughly about 12 hours. This is the time that it would take from people to travel from Wuhan to either Africa, New York, and so on and so forth. So, and the third thing I want to talk to you about, I would provoke you to think about, is that when you want to design healthcare system, that system must be evidence-based, and meaning that you must actually, you know, think about it in the, from a scientific point and not political motives. And then when it comes to Africa more particularly, we are late in the game in terms of developing our healthcare infrastructure. But I want to proceed to you that that's going to be an advantage, because we can see what has worked and what has not worked and learn from it. And that is sometimes the advantage of being a latecomer on the scene, even though there are so many disadvantages. And so by designing a healthcare, you have to think about a human being from conception to death. And therefore, health starts from conception, from antenatal care, to at the time when you go down 6 feet. So think about it that way. And then we also have to think about, in specifically for Africa, that healthcare must actually be undergirded by prevention must undergird the African system, a healthcare system, not treatment. So by the time people get to the hospital, they've already failed, you know, so most of the time. So you think about it that way. And then and when it comes to, and I also like to challenge you young folks to think on the African continent, to think somehow some people have gotten it into your head to thinking that you are stupid, to thinking that you are dull, to thinking that you are less intelligent than anyone else. But I tell you that stupidity, morality are all randomly distributed. That means if I go to Kenya, I go to Sudan, I go to Malawi, I go to Tanzania, and I go to Japan, I go to China, I go to the United States, and pick randomly any 10 of you, I will have an equal proportion of stupid and smart people. I will have an equal proportion of, you know, moral and immoral people. And so then the next question you're going to ask me is, then why is Africa always lacking behind? The problem is environmental. It's not ontological. And do that, you have to also, you know, take that very, very seriously. And the last thing I would talk before I get into, the last provocation I will give you this morning, which is like your coffee before I get into the retalk, would be, to ask you yourself, you know, to talk about this concept that I've always thought about, and of course with my very good friend and Professor Lumumba, it's about the African duality, what I call the African duality, which is the typical African, irrespective of wherever I go, is actually very, very empathetic, moral, spiritual, communal. Think about in terms of communal things, and they will offer you even things they don't have. But exactly those same people, when they get up to power, then when they get to power, something switches, and these people become devils. And then you ask yourself, are these the same people? Are these the same Africans? Unfortunately, when people talk about Africa in the West, when people talk about Africa in the outside world, that's the African they are talking about. They are not talking about you and me. But you have the way, you have the, all the world without to change it. And I would actually finish that by letting you know a quote from Max Planck, who talked about a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grow up that is familiar with that truth. So you guys, it is on you. It is not on us. It is not on that older generation to really like be able to take matters into your own hands as you think about redesigning African, the healthcare system in Africa, redesigning everything in Africa. And you must challenge, you must be willing to stand up and die for what you believe in. Anything short of that, that's, you are not winning. Now, what do we define health to be? Various people have defined health, but I would say take the WHO definition that defines health not just as a state of physical, social, and that defines health as a state of physical, social, and psychological well-being, not just the absence of disease or infirmity. So therefore, you can really not be happy if you don't have a job. If you graduate college, you don't have a job, 40 years on, you're still living in your father's house. How can you be healthy? You cannot have a job if you actually oppressed at work, if you're a woman who is discriminated and, you know, and you're a girl child who is actually also always told to take a second fiddle as if you were subhuman and things and so on and so forth. So social injustice, therefore, is a real big block in social health. And I would actually, you know, go back. I think one of the panelists that talked about, you know, poverty as a disease. Yes, it is the one of the biggest diseases that we have. Now, for so long, African systems are very, very fragile. And the reason why they've been very fragile is that, you know, they have chronically underinvested in healthcare. We have actually tended to want to copy things from the West that don't work in Africa. And rather than being very, very imaginative and original in our thinking, if you think about health expenditure, for instance, they will tell you that Africa, you know, in 2017 had the constituted about, accounted for about 25% of the global disease burden, had about 3% of the world health health professionals, and spent less than 1% of the world health expenditure. How can that be? And in 2001, at the Abuja Declaration, during the Abuja conference, the what became known as the Abuja Declaration, actually said, you know, that African countries should spend not more, less than 15% of their GDP on healthcare. How many of these countries actually do that? But they will spend a lot more of this money on war and actually on things that have nothing to do with the good of humanity. So I was the one of the other, our problems go from expenditure, from chronic underinvestment to unimaginative, you know, thinking about healthcare, and to really, you know, waste, corruption, fraud, lack of, you know, laws to actually hold, you know, professionals to account and actually preventing quacks, you know, from competing with professionals. And I would actually just give you a little bit of, I want to start with a summary because the time is a little bit short. So I'll start thinking about, you know, what has COVID taught us? In COVID and the event in America, which is actually the killing of George Floyd, have taught us that there are certain things about healthcare, that healthcare, when there is a shock in the system, as we saw with COVID, The people to suffer the most are the least vulnerable, are the most vulnerable. And those are people who already probably have pre-existing health conditions, people who don't have good nutrition, people who already have, don't have good access to healthcare and so on and so forth. And this is why the black people in America die much more than the rest of the races here in America. And the judge of death, the death of George Floyd here, actually, you know, as evocative as it was, as emotive as it was, you know, long before that police officer a young Americans, black Americans are old enough to have the police officer even put their knees on their neck, the healthcare system, health injustice,
Sorry to come in. Your audio is not good at this point, but just so that we're keeping to time, I'll just give you one more minute to just summarize quickly.
Can you hear me better?
It's better now. One more minute.
Please. All right. So I think when you're redesigning the healthcare system that you think about in the future, you should think about three things. You know, access, affordability, and the quality of that care. And so, in order to think about this access, you should think about it has to be predicated on science. What does science say about that disease? If you take a hospital that can treat people with heart attacks and put it somewhere in where it takes about 3 hours to drive, yes, the person would die in 5 minutes of a heart attack, then that person doesn't have access. Affordability means if you actually have a healthcare system, even if it is there, but the people cannot actually afford it, that person doesn't have access to that care because they cannot afford it. And in terms of quality, we have to not just think about the number of hospitals. We need to think about what are the qualities of those hospitals. Think about the private-public partnership in terms of how you invest it. So every hospital, every country should have a national health insurance. But we should, if you know people like the Dangote, the Mo Ibrahims and stuff like the rich people within the continent, please let them know that one of the areas where they can come in and actually invest is in healthcare infrastructure. So we can create a healthcare system whereby you have primary care, you have secondary healthcare, you have tertiary care at the level of the university, of the teaching hospitals. But then we should have also regional research centers in Africa across most African countries so that those regional centers would actually attract and prevent our older power brokers from actually having to go to Europe or to the Americas to have healthcare, which is far more expensive. But it would allow us to use our incredible youth and talent that we have.
Absolutely.
I think it looks like my time is up, but my email is there. You guys have my information, and then we can talk more about this. This is something that we could talk for 2 hours nonstop, and we would still have more data to go over. Thank you.
Thank you very much. and our deputy president, our secretary general, DSG and the DG, our provincial chairperson, and the PCT members and all RCT members. In particular, Kangala RCT and all our ground forces who made this day possible. We salute you for doing a wonderful job. We want to salute more your chairperson of the province, because when we enter here, we can feel that we are going to a rally of the EFF. You have painted this place red. Even those who are not here at the rally, they know the EFF is in town because of the type of work you have done on the ground before this rally. That's how rallies are organized. Fighters, we are here today to celebrate the workers of the wealth. We are not only celebrating our saving resources of Africa, but this day belongs to the whole working class all over the world. It was on this day
further ado, I'd like to welcome a person that I have felt deeply fortunate to know, and I've actually told her this. When I first saw her speak, I said, I've been waiting for you since Sékou Touré passed away. And she has not only stepped into those giants of Kwame Nkrumah, Sékou Touré, and others of the independence movement, she has actually filled them so much so that we have to bring new shoes for the kind of presence that that she has. I'd like to welcome Her Excellency Ambassador Chihombori Kau. As a Francophone, I have to be very careful how to pronounce that. Ambassador.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to your home. The Great Africa House, right here in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. To the presidents who are sitting at the podium, I want to take a moment to thank you for taking your time in your busy schedules to come and join us on this momentum occasion. To my sisters, Chairman of President of NAPIO, thank you again. This was last minute, but you had the call and you answered and you jumped up and you are here today. To my sister, Ms. Jensen, to my brother, Kojo Yanka, some of you, I have to give a shout out. He's writing a book titled From Gemstown to Gemstown. I can't wait, it's gonna be a thriller. To all my other diaspora sisters, members of PADIA, members of PADWA, we truly are grateful for you taking the time to come here today. Roland Martin, back there, this is my first time to see you in person. A lot of people don't look the same on television as they are in person. I have to say, you look exactly like what I had expected you to look like. Thank you for taking the time to come here. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed an honor to stand in front of you this afternoon to celebrate this momentous occasion. And of course, I always forget my husband, Sab Kwao. He's sitting somewhere back there. Sab, raise your hand. Everybody's looking. A friend of mine reminded me, because I always call him, he's an old shoe that is very comfortable to wear. And so a friend of mine called this morning and said, so how is the old comfortable shoe? And I said, still very comfortable. Thank you all again. And my sister Remy, Chairman of PADWA, thank you again for also always being there, ready to step up and do your part as we come together to uplift our motherland. I took office 2.5 years ago as a dumb, ignorant family physician coming from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I had no idea what I was going to be doing in Washington. As a matter of fact, I actually felt kind of funny and silly thinking me, a medical doctor, can be a diplomat. But be it as it may, singularly the one thing, I came here, by the way, with no plans of staying. I was coming here top 6 months after 6 months. Look at my husband, honey, I tried. It didn't work out. Look at the chairman of the African Union who had appointed me. Thank you, Madam Zuma. It was great, but I could not do it. But 6 months into this position, one issue that kept coming to me and became very apparent was the disrespect for the African. I knew it existed. I just didn't understand the depth and the profoundness of it. And not only that, as I began to understand it even deeper, I began to also understand its economic implications when it comes to how we are perceived on the world stage, how this simple fact of simply disrespecting the African had serious implications and is at the root cause of why Africa is not able to move forward. And as I went and tried to understand and dig further to say, what is it about us as black people around the globe? Why is it that we are so disrespected no matter where you go? And I often say, was there a memo sent out to say wherever you go, if you are not a black person, you see a black person, you're automatically superior to them, and you have a right to disrespect them. This memo did not miss anybody. It went to non-black people, but here's the real shocker. It also went to us black people to say, accept that you are inferior. You automatically take an inferior position. And I'm going to have to tell you something that has become a realization that I just, and this is where I am stuck as I try to understand, how did this message just go through and percolated so through? Now we are on automatic pilot. It's almost as if we had undergone a genetic mutation. We don't even have to be told. We pass it on to our children. Have you ever wondered, of all the colors on earth, why were two colors chosen? Black color and white color. Follow me on this one. You take a white color, you associate it with Jesus Christ. You associate it with the angels. You associate it with purity and everything wonderful and everything desirable. And then you take a race that's not even white and you say you are white. Yeah. And then you take another color. You associate it with the devil. You associate it with everything undesirable. I've never seen a bank robber wearing a white mask. All the villains on movies are black. Everything undesirable is black. And then you take another race that are not even black and say, you guys, you are black. Yeah. Now go at it. As we black mothers are trying to raise our children in our own homes, as much as we try to tell them that you're black and you're beautiful, guess what? The minute they step outside the door, the messages are completely different. A barrage of subliminal messages telling our children that that which you represent is horrible. How do we fight against that? How do I tell my granddaughter that you're black and beautiful, but the world tells her otherwise? The voices echoing her blackness as a symbol of everything undesirable are much, much louder than even we black mothers. We come together, we can never drown those subliminal messages. They were all by design. Let me take you to the beginning. Certainly for Africa, your Africa, your continent. Because as we gather here today, as we try to strategize, as we try to create those linkages between those Africans away from the continent and the Africans on the continent, we must understand, how did we get here? And for Africa, it starts with that monumental decision when they, the colonizers, came together in Berlin in 1884. And let me say, prior to 1884, they were coming to Africa in a haphazard way. They had started with slavery. And then when they felt like they needed the slaves to stay on the continent, they say, oh, we no longer believe in slave trade. Let's stop it. No. It was really just another way of saying the labor is needed on the continent. Let's keep the monkeys on the continent so we can continue to exploit them. So 1884, they met in Berlin to organize themselves so they can effectively loot from the monkeys. They did not meet in Berlin to see to it that Africa would prosper. Now, let me repeat. The colonizers met in order to see to it that your Africa, our Africa, and her children, not only on the continent, are forever defeated and dominated. That was 135 years ago. The manner in which they did it, they took out the map of Africa while the Africans were sleeping, minding their own business. Started to chop up your continent into the tiny little countries that we see today. The bigger and more powerful a kingdom was, the more countries that came out of it. Not only more countries, but these countries were given to different colonizers who spoke different languages. Let me bring it home for a second. Pretend you're driving from Zambia. You're speaking English. Pretty soon you are in Angola. You're speaking Portuguese. Then DRC, French. Equatorial Guinea, Spanish. Southern Cameroon, French. Southern Cameroon, English. Northern Cameroon, French. You are now in Nigeria, English. Hello. These were the same people. Prior to 1884, we were powerful, amazing kingdoms with well-established educational and religious systems. If the truth be told, we had the civilization. We were the civilized. They were the devils, the uncivilized ones. They set out to take everything that symbolized civilization in Africa. To this day, they're still refusing to give up those relics. If those relics were not that good, why are you keeping them? We were way ahead of them in our civilization. They set out to destroy us. And Berlin Conference put the nail on that coffin. So they gave Djibouti the same sovereignty as the United States. They gave Burundi the same sovereignty as China. They gave Togo. You see, the EU realizes individual little countries, they can't survive on the world stage. So they came together as the European Union. Now picture this now. So they cut up this Africa into the tiny little countries, small economies that could never survive on their own, but gave them the same sovereignty as the big boys. So that way, when the little bitty countries go to the world stage for the purposes of development and discussing trade, they're wannabe boxers who are being thrown into the heavyweight boxing ring every day. How do you put China in the same boxing ring with Eswatini? Eswatini has 1.2 million people. China has 1.4 billion people. And you put them on the same stage and say, go at it, negotiate. Are you with me? This is insanity of the highest order. How have we allowed this carnage to go on? When Eswatini is thrown in the same boxing ring with China and Eswatini collapses before Eswatini even gets on the stage, the world says, well, Eswatini, what's wrong with you? Why can't you take care of your people? Well, China came in and said, Eswatini, give me all your gold or else. And if Eswatini does not agree, they just go on next door to Lesotho and give Lesotho an extra dollar. And if Lesotho doesn't take it, they just jump on to Togo, Central African Republic. It was all by design. 1884. They did something else in addition to chopping us up. They also set out to make the African believe that everything African was bad and undesirable, and everything Western, particularly French and British, was more desirable. We call that the legacy of colonization. Prior to that, they had started long working on the slaves. Make them think everything about them, forget anything about Africa. Where you come from is a horrible place with diseased and dying people, constantly at war with themselves, uncivilized. Cut out any communications with them. You need to just know what we tell you. And we call that the legacy of slavery. So that way, you look at where we are today. 135 years later, a system that was put in place to see to it that Africa and her children are forever defeated, that Africa is forever exploited, remains in place today, alive and well. And we sit here and we ask ourselves, why isn't Africa moving forward? Why does Africa continue to be taken advantage of? Well, I'll tell you why, very simply. Until Africa comes together as a continent speaking with one voice, one continent, one people, nothing, and I repeat, nothing is going to change. As individual little African countries, we are wannabe boxers. We will never make it fighting against the heavyweights. We must speak with one voice. Yeah. And this is exactly what our Pan-African leaders wanted to see happen in 1963 when they came together in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. They clearly stated that Africa for the Africans at home and abroad, and that African Union was now. They said Africa must speak with one voice. It is the only way for Africa to take its rightful place on the world stage. Sadly, when they went to Addis Ababa in 1963, they were divided. We had two factions, the Casablanca group and the Monrovia group. The Casablanca group were saying Africa for the Africans at home and abroad, and African Union now. This was Ghana, Guinea, Mali, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Only seven. The other 25 of the 32 who attended were the Monrovia group. They were the nationalists. They said, let's go slow. Let's kind of wait on this Pan-African thing. 55 years later, 56 this year, we're still going slow. As if it wasn't bad enough that we were divided up into the tiny little countries that we are today. The gift that Berlin Conference gave us. One other thing that France did between 1958 and 1961, in the name of giving us our independence as African countries. France forced the Francophone, and I hate that terminology. There is no such thing as Francophone, Anglophone. They made it up. But for the purposes of communication, I will use that. 14 of those countries, they said, in order for you to get your independence from us, you must sign this document. You thought they could have found a better name for the document. The document was called the Pact for the Continuation. I repeat, the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization. We are talking about giving you independence, but sign this pact for the continuation of colonization in a different format. And I'm going to highlight some of those issues that they said you must agree to if you are going to be independent. Hello. Maybe we need to redefine the meaning of independence for the French. France said, you see, you monkeys, you don't know how to manage your money. We're going to demand that you deposit 85% of your bank reserves with the French Minister of Finance, under the French Central Bank, under the control of the French Minister of Finance. France is then going to take your 85% bank deposits from each and every one of you. Deposit those funds in the French stock market under the French name. And you may or may not know the returns. Today, as we speak, the latest figures are saying for every 14 billion that France invests in the stock market from Africa, they are realizing upwards of 300 billion in return. Every year, year in, year out, because of these deposits from the African countries, France is taking out of Africa over $500 billion. Now figure it out. For every 14 billion, the returns on the investment are over 300 billion, and they are taking over 500 billion. So in actuality, France is taking out of Africa trillions of dollars, year in and year out, from us poor people, Africans. Back to the pact. So should you want to access some of your money that you have deposited with France, you have to submit your country's financial returns. And if approved, you get to get it as a loan. You can only access up to 20% of your money year in, year out, as a loan at commercial interest rates. Your own money. As if that was not enough. They said all your minerals discovered, yet to be discovered, all your oil discovered, yet to be discovered, France and French companies have the first right of refusal. If there's anything left over that the French companies do not want, your people might have. To this day. They said you will only use the currency that we created for you because you are special Africans. We call it the CFA. There was the Central African CFA and the Western African CFA, same animal. And that France is the only one that can print it for you. 1958, fast forward, they're still printing it for us. And if you start misbehaving, they just stop printing your money and your country's in trouble. They also said your language of instruction shall be French, whether you like it or not. That France will have military presence in your country. That your military can only be trained by France. That you can only buy military equipment from France. That you cannot have any military alliance with your neighbor. And that in the event of war, your allegiance is only to France. And furthermore, because they have military presence in your country, they can invade you without notice should they feel that the interests of France in your country are being violated. Fast forward, 2019, nothing has changed. The same people who have the audacity to tell us that we are poor countries, they are taking trillions out of Africa every year. And what is the African doing? Like an obedient, programmed black man, we just give in. We know the facts, but we just do nothing about it. Now, you have to say some of the fears are real, because the France that has sold you inferior equipment to theirs, France that has trained your military to be inferior to their military, they are now in your country. They can invade you. They have the permission to do so. They can destabilize you. And then one might say, why is it that African leaders haven't done anything about this deplorable situation? Well, let me tell you, my brother and sister, they have tried. Documented to this day, 22 coups where leaders were assassinated. France had something to do with it. The first seven, when they decided they were pulling out of the CFA and that they're going to print their own money, they were assassinated. Every time an African leader has tried to do what's best for their country, they were assassinated, majority of them aided by France. It's a known fact. And then others, they were just mercenaries who felt that when there was a natural resource discovered in one country, they wanted to create a coup. So while the country is thrown into a civil war, they're siphoning the natural resource. We know of one particular story that had we not known about it, it would have been, oh, there we go again, the Africans. In about 25 years ago, a group of young, rich, white kids were having fun in Cape Town. They found out that there was oil in Equatorial Guinea that just been discovered, and they wanted it. So they set out a plan to have a coup in Equatorial Guinea. So while the Guineans are busy fighting a civil war, they will be siphoning the oil. But they made one mistake. There were two planes. One was to leave South Africa, stop in Zimbabwe, pick up more ammunition on their way to hunt in Equatorial Guinea. Another plane was taking off in the Caribbean that had this puppet diaspora who was supposed to be the next president. Mugabe wondered why such young people needed such powerful ammunition to go hunt in Equatorial Guinea. In doing his research further, he found out that this was a coup in the making. He allowed them to land in Zimbabwe. They loaded their plane, and just before takeoff, they were all arrested. The ringleader of that group was none other than the son of the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher. She had to fly to Zimbabwe and paid handsomely to get her son out. The last one of those prisoners left Zimbabwe about 6-7 years ago. Had these young people succeeded, it would have been another coup. There you go, the Africans again. Such, my brothers and sisters, is the story of your Africa. They don't do coups anymore. They simply create instability. So when you hear of an instability in an African country, ask yourself, what is really going on? Because what they are telling you is really going on is just a shiny object. The real issue is over here. And you need to stop before you start being used as an instrument of your own self-destruction. They want to throw to you, our African leaders are corrupt. I just love that buzzword. Remember what I said, we need to define some of these words for them. Do you really want to know what corruption is? I like to think as black women, and we're going to talk about us black women here. We're smart people. There are two thieves. One is carrying a briefcase with $50 billion, which is what they say, oh, gets out of Africa every year for corruption. And by the way, they only tell you the $50 billion gets out of Africa. They don't tell you where it's going. You see, corruption is a team sport. We want all players. We want all players to come to the table. Okay, fine, we give it to you. $50 billion is going out of Africa. And then there's another thief over here with a briefcase with $500 billion. Sisters, which one should we go after first? Yeah. They want us to spend time. I am not saying we should not talk about corruption out of Africa. Don't get me wrong. Yes, we must talk about the thief carrying the $50 billion, but we must also not forget the thief that is carrying $500 billion. And by the time that thief is done investing that $500 billion, we're looking at trillions out of Africa. Now, do you see how quickly the $50 billion becomes the larger crumb under the table? And they're busy pointing at you. Oh, you see your brother, he got the bigger crumb under the table. I'm like, hell no. I want to be on the table. Don't get me stuck in the mud under the table when the real issues are on the table. We are not even on the table, my brothers and sisters, to tackle the issues that truly matter for our Africa. We must realize that. Let's refuse to fight over which brother got the bigger chunk under the table.
That's right.
We want to get on the table.
That's right.
And the only way for us to get on the table is to understand our circumstances, is to understand how we got here, to see our Africa with 2020 vision. So we, the beautiful, intelligent, sophisticated, highly adaptable, and totally indestructible Africans can do what we need to do to move our Africa from the doldrums where we were left by the Berlin Conference, from the losing lane that we were left in by the Berlin Conference, into the right lane, where we can truly look at our issues and address them as Africans for Africa. So all is not lost, my brothers and sisters. The wishes of our Pan-African fathers from 1963, March last year, the African leaders got together and signed a decision that is now putting us on the path to finish the unfinished business of the Berlin Conference. They signed what we are now calling the African Continental Free Trade Area, where Africa is now going to negotiate as a bloc, as one continent, one Africa, one heart, one soul, one mind. Yes. Two African heads of state signed that agreement. We only needed 22 to ratify. Exactly 13 months later, this is something that the colonizers were laughing at us. You Africans, you'll never put this through. This CFTA thing, you'll never get the ratifications. Years down the line, it's never going to happen. It's going to be a piece of paper in a drawer somewhere. Because the reality is, ratifications, my brothers and sisters, do take a long time. They take years. But guess what? 13 months. April this year, the 22nd ratification was deposited to the African Union. We're now sitting on 23 and more are coming. Because you know what? The sleeping giant is rising. The sleeping giant has found her teeth and used recognize. Let me underscore. The sleeping giant has found her teeth. Her teeth. Game is over. When I speak to businesses in this country, my mandate is to see to it that Africa and the United States are the best partners the world has ever seen. America, the United States, and the Americas is the only region that has a heritage connection to Africa. And it is for that reason in particular that I'm on a mission to see to it that the marriage between Africa and the United States is the best marriage the world has ever seen. It is a marriage that's going to give birth not only to many children, but many beautiful children. I'm a woman on a mission.
Yeah.
And that's why. That is why it is important that we begin to understand each other. That the misconceptions, the misunderstandings, the Africans don't understand the Americans, and the Americans don't understand the Africans. Our Caucasian brothers and sisters come to the negotiating table on a high horse. To them I say, get off your high horse.
Yeah.
And we come to the negotiating table feeling automatically inferior. I also say to all of us, you are just as good as anybody else. Get off that underground. You need to rise up somewhere in the middle. We must rise up, they must come down. And somewhere in the middle is where we are going to have the truly desired, meaningful conversations that are going to take us where we need to be. And this is why we are here today.
Thank you.
My son Kwame, I thank you for all the wonderful creating that bridge that's going to get us to the table with a clear mind, clear vision, understanding that when we understand each other, it is then and only then can the children of Africa take their beloved continent to its rightful place on the world stage, the place that we have vacated for far too long. But we are now saying enough is enough. We, the children of Africa, as a united friend, we are going to come join our hands and sing the best melody the world has ever heard as we waltz our way to our motherland, not as 55 African countries, not as 1.27 billion brothers and sisters on the continent, not as over 400 million African diaspora around the globe, but children of One Mother Africa. Let's give the world the best melody the world has ever heard. You see, birds sing not because they can. They sing because they have a song. As children of One Mother Africa, we do have a song. Let's join hands. Let's give that world that beautiful song as we waltz our way across the Atlantic back to the motherland. I thank you.